Clay Jenkinson is the man behind the costume when we do Teddy Roosevelt and Thomas Jefferson. 1 week from tomorrow, we're going to be at Elgin Community College's Blizzard Theater, and I asked Clay to join us one more time just to preview the show a little bit. Hi, Clay. How are you?
Hey, my friend. How are you?
I'm good. By the way, you know, so when we get ready to do one of our shows on stage, you will come on in costume and as Theodore Roosevelt, and I'll come on as John Williams, local American talk show host. You and I talk a little bit, then people get a chance to ask questions to Teddy as well. And as I get ready for the show, I always Google Teddy Roosevelt News. And he is in the news a little bit these days, which is kind of cool for somebody who's been dead for 100 years, right?
What has he done this time?
Well, Scaramucci brought him up. Anthony Scaramucci brought him up and said that it was one of his anti-Trump rants. And he said that, you know, he would not be up on Mount Rushmore with Teddy Roosevelt, who is one of the greatest presidents of all time. So you got that going for you. Here's a headline today. Raffle offers deer hunt with modern-day Teddy Roosevelt, Donald Trump Jr. So if you want to go hunting with Donald Trump Jr., like, I don't know, did Teddy Roosevelt, did they raffle off a chance to go hunt with him?
No, of course not. And, you know, some things are sane and some things are insane. But to compare Theodore Roosevelt with Donald Trump Jr., is obscenity. Theodore Roosevelt wrote 40 books. He read a book a day. He was maybe the best intellectually prepared president in American history. He had geopolitical understanding that enabled him to sort of bring the United States into the 20th century. In fact, he essentially reinvented the presidency and inaugurated what's been called the American century. He was a very gifted linguist. He was a man of extraordinary capacity in almost an unbelievable range of areas. He was an explorer who explored the last uncharted river in South America. And to compare him to the son of a billionaire who has never had to do any of the hard reading, the hard thinking, the disciplined work in life is just openly appalling. And that would be true if this were a claim made by Barack Obama for one of his daughters. Roosevelt doesn't get to be compared to routine human beings, whatever their political affiliation.
You know, I just finished this latest book about his crowded hour, about his charge up Kettle Hill, San Juan Hill, it's famously called, and in the Spanish-American War, which was fought in Cuba, and which Americans really don't have much recollection of or understanding of. And it wasn't one of our great wars. It was this skirmish down there. But I say all of that to say this, having read this book about the war in Cuba, Roosevelt was the real deal. He was in the trenches with those guys. He really did run and ride in front of the fire and led the troops. There were some other generals who laid back. There were some soldiers who, when they got there, realized this was more than they had bargained for. But if Roosevelt stands on stage next Saturday and says, you know, I was in the thick of it. I am a true war hero. I'm not going to argue with him. He really was, right?
He was. In addition to that, as you know from reading this really interesting book, he went out of his way. So he signed a circular letter insisting that the troops after the war was won were just being left there and that they were getting sick and that this was unconscionably bad logistics. And when his men were hungry for some real food, he went behind the lines and found an American purveyor and he bought bags of beans at his own expense to take to his men. I mean, this is not a grandstanding sort of person. He was capable of grandstanding, but he was, as you say, the real McCoy here. And if you compare him to Bill Clinton, who was a draft dodger, and to G.W. Bush, who got a cushy job in the Air National Guard and didn't even show up for that, and, of course, the current president who had, some sort of foot problem that prevented him from fighting in Vietnam, you see the difference. You can say what you want about Theodore Roosevelt, John, that, you know, that he was a jingoist and a warmonger and that there's a kind of a wacky, violent streak of bloodlust in him. But he was a true patriot, and he understood that if you want to be the leader of this country, you don't duck the wars of your time. You don't get a doctor to say, oh, you have foot problems, therefore you can't do what average Americans had to go and do in 1968 or 1970.
Yeah.
And I don't want to pick on Trump. Bill Clinton is our first draft dodger president, and he somehow got away with it. So it's a different era.
Well, he really, how old was he when he went to Cuba? Was he in his 40s?
He was in his 40s. He's a little too old for this, and his wife was deathly ill. She had had a terrible gynecological problem and a serious operation at a time when that was really life-threatening, and she begged him not to go. But he later said that he would have left her deathbed to go fight in that war.
And he really wanted to. I mean, which is another thing I don't understand. I don't understand that bloodlust on his own part, like willing to shed
me
his
either.
Own. But I don't understand why American, like, so he, the Rough Riders were this group of people that he was able to get. It was elites from the East and cowboys from the West, and this amalgam of Americana wanted to fight with him. But the whole, people were in tears that they would not be allowed to go to Cuba and fight in the war. And by the way, they had machine guns back then. I mean, it wasn't going to be a romp. I don't understand why we wanted to fight in Cuba so much.
Well, we know too much now. You know, we have media 24 hours per day, 7 days a week. We get to see the mayhem of war. It's not quite so heroic, and particularly not since World War One. You know, the Cuba was what John Hay, the Secretary of State, called a splendid little war, kind of a fun little war, but it was more serious than we think, as you've discovered in this book. But if you think of what happened in 1914, when the people of Britain and the people of Germany and the people of France marched off to war, you know, joyfully, people waving their handkerchiefs at them, "We'll be back by Christmas." It was going to be glorious. This was going to tone up European society. And 5 years later, there were 25 million killed, people who were literally mown down by machine guns across the no man's land in northern France. So the industrialization of warfare that happened beginning with the Civil War and had a kind of a blip during the Spanish-American War found its true expression in World War One. And I just came back from 10 days in England. The British are still more appalled by what happened in World War One than they are by what happened in World War Two, because World War One was such just a profound shock to the idea of a civilization that had produced Shakespeare and Beethoven.
You know, I'll stop talking to you about Cuba now, but wasn't it after that that he gave a famous speech about the strenuous life and the virtue of it? And I think he gave that in Chicago, didn't he?
He did, and it became the title of one of his 40 books. And it really became almost his life's mission statement. And you know what? I agree with him. Not about war, not about killing elephants and, you know, white rhinoceroses. Those things don't appeal to me, but his patriotism does in the wars. But I'll tell you, the idea of the strenuous life, it's so fun to talk about, but we are an out-of-shape nation with a really lousy diet and a lot of Barca loungers and a lot of NFL on Sundays. And Roosevelt's view would be, you stop watching the Detroit Lions and the Chicago Bears and get out and hike, get out and row a boat, get out and do something. I mean, America has become a really sedentary, and frankly obese nation of opioids and all the stuff that we all talk about all the time.
He was a teetotaler, too. He didn't drink beer.
He wasn't going to do any of that. He was a sarsaparilla man, John. So when you and I go out for our celebratory lunch on that Saturday, you can have all the gin and tonic you want. I have to have only sarsaparilla.
I don't even know what sarsaparilla is, but what's that, root beer or something? It's not alcoholic,
yeah,
right?
It's a root beer. It's a Diet Coke for 1902, you know. But he actually sued a newspaper in Michigan over this because they said he was publicly drunk during the 1912 Bull Moose campaign. And so he sued them, and he won, and he got the mandatory lowest settlement. It was 6 cents. That's all he wanted. He was just trying to prove a point. But one of his friends, John, he called in all of his friends from all over the place to come give depositions for him. And one of his friends on the witness stand said, look, He just seems drunk.
It's funny. So, as I told you a moment ago, Clay Jenkinson is on a phone line. You may recognize his voice. A version of that comes out of his mouth when he's on stage with us, either acting as Teddy Roosevelt or Thomas Jefferson. It'll be Roosevelt on stage with us at the Elgin Community College Blizzard Theater next Saturday. So I told you I typed in Roosevelt in news to see what pops up, and there's Scaramucci, and you know, there's a library story about a Roosevelt library in North Dakota. Don Jr. is going to be the modern-day Teddy Roosevelt on a hunt. But another story popped up. Teddy Roosevelt got sued for libel. He said he enjoyed it very much. It's the way this reads, that whole thing was not a lark for him, but a chance for him to sit on the, you know, in the witness stand and talk for a while was good for him.
Well, that's a great story. I can't go into details, but we should do it on stage next Saturday. But what happened was that he was sued for libel by a man named Barnes in New York, and he had called him a corruptionist and a crook and, you know, crony capitalism and all that. And so this could have destroyed Roosevelt. He could have really lost reputation and a ton of money. So he's in the trial, and he gets on the stand, and he tells, like, stories of hunting in Africa and stories of all of his other exploits. And the judge keeps saying, hey, stick to the case here. But the whole crowd is like, no, more, tell us stories. And then the Lusitania was sunk, and there were a bunch of German-Americans on the jury, and Roosevelt's handler said, just for once in your whole life, I mean, just once, just keep your mouth shut. If you go out and talk about this, you're going to lose this case, and it's going to be the end of everything for you. So he leaves the court, gets out there, and says, I want to talk about what's happened with the Lusitania. And he gives this impassioned attack on Germany, and he says, if I had been president and I had known that that ship was going to sail, and they'd put ads in the newspaper saying that the Americans should probably not sail on it and so on, he said, I would have marched down the entire diplomatic corps of Germany, the ambassador and all of his staff, and put him on the Lusitania and said, now, if you want to sink it, go right ahead, you Huns. And so his handlers were just like Trump's must be at this moment.
Well,
just like, oh boy. But he won. So the jury found for him because he was right, and they loved it. And he was like, tell us another story about a bear, would you?
When he survived his assassination attempt, a guy came up and shot him point blank. He survived that. Was that in nearby Milwaukee that took place?
Yes, but he convalesced in Chicago. So he was shot at an auditorium in Milwaukee on October 14th, 1912. He then went on to give an 84-minute speech with the bullet in him and blood pouring out of his chest. When he finally went to the hospital, they kind of figured, they did an x-ray, it was very new then, and they realized that the bullet was not going to kill him, so they left it in him for the rest of his life. And then he was transferred to Chicago, where his wife Edith came out, and he convalesced in your city, the Chicago Hog Butcher of the World, where I'll be next Saturday.
So, protocol is that a sitting president does not criticize the past presidents, and past presidents don't meddle in the affairs of the current president. Barack Obama's been largely silent about Donald Trump, but Donald Trump has not let Barack Obama, or for that matter, Hillary Clinton, go. I wonder what Roosevelt would have said about that. How did he react to the president before him or the president after him?
Well, we know this, so I won't say what he would think about the current president, but go ahead and do the math on your own time. Roosevelt was so awful to Woodrow Wilson that he may have been the worst former president ever with respect to his successors. I mean, he set the standard for the worst possible behavior of a former president to a duly elected president of the United States.
What did he do?
Woodrow Wilson, he thought Wilson was a wimp, that all this talk about making the world safe for democracy, and, you know, was there something of being too proud to fight, and all that. He just thought, that's nuts. And he was right. His view was, we are going to get in the war. We're going to have to. We're America. And we better get in sooner, because if we don't, we'll lose our chance to control the post-war fate of the world. And by not being prepared for this, we're only making things worse and really leading to the death of millions of Europeans. We're America. We have to get in this war. And he thought Wilson was just an insane, just like a moron for not doing this. And he called him names. He wrote article after article. I mean, he makes Trump look like a sissy when it comes to name calling. One of the names he called Wilson was a Byzantine logothete. We don't even know what that means, but he called him a Byzantine logothete. I'm going to call you that on the stage.
I do. I have time to load up a response.
But no, H.L. Mencken, who was a great journalist and sarcast and satirist, said, watching Roosevelt behave towards Wilson, he said, the best thing we could do with our former presidents is just take them out and shoot them.
Oh, gosh. Well, no, we can't do that. But in fact, I thought that after Roosevelt's second term, his first full term, he then went away to Africa. Didn't he sort of get out of Dodge as a favor to Wilson so people wouldn't be...
You know, you could do the program next Saturday because you and I have done this before. You know all the punchlines.
I do not.
You could do both sides, John. You're not mean enough.
I'm not convincing.
Yeah, he went on a year-long safari in Africa. And, you know, and he says about that, so he wanted to get out of Taft's way so that Taft could establish his own rhythm and didn't want Taft looking over his shoulder all the time and so on. He said, imagine following me.
Exactly.
Imagine following me. So he was right about that. So he went on this year-long safari with his son Kermit, and then he did a grand tour of Europe. And he went to the funeral of King Edward in London, and he gave lectures at Oxford, and he got his Nobel Peace Prize, and he gave the famous speech at the Sorbonne on October of 1910, where he says, it's not the critic who counts, the credit belongs to the man who's actually in the arena.
Yeah.
And so this was a great period in Roosevelt's life. And then he came back in June 1910, and it was the largest parade in the history of New York City. I mean, he was like a world historical beloved citizen coming home after his time away, like a president in exile almost. And then he turned on Taft and ran in 1912 in the Bull Moose campaign and got 29%, which is gigantic. But as you know, not enough to elect a president. And so it all sort of deteriorated after that.
So imagine that. I mean, you're Donald Trump. You win the presidency. A year later, Barack Obama comes back after a year in Africa, and the largest parade in the history of New York greets him like a returning hero. Or just do the math on any two presidents. The ex-president comes back after a year. That had to gall then the sitting president, right? Hurt his feelings a little bit.
It did, but it also, I mean, he got it. I mean, Taft loved Roosevelt, and he got it. He got it. Like, this only happens... This is like the black swan, you know. This only happens once every hundreds and hundreds of years that a person of this magnitude. So imagine if Donald Trump were a man of many languages and one of the most brilliantly educated men in the world and who knew all of the economics and the geopolitics and water issues and global climate issues, and he was a master of almost everything, and he had a mythology of being this man of extraordinary righteousness and virtue. Imagine Trump's energy level and his charisma coupled with a true genius. Now you've got Roosevelt, and so anyone who follows him is going to be like, wow, how do you even get any attention in this country when you're following a man of that sort? And so Taft understood this, and he accepted it. But what he didn't get was that Roosevelt could not stand not to be in power, that it killed him to be out of power. And so he was going to do what it took to get back at the center of the arena, including roll over one of his best friends, William Howard Taft, if necessary. So that's the darker side of the Roosevelt persona. And I think we see that in people of this sort that have these gigantic egos. You don't see that in G.W. Bush. Certainly not. He's been an extraordinary former president. You see it a little in Jimmy Carter from time to time. You don't see it all in Barack Obama. He's been unbelievably restrained in the face of provocation. I'm guessing we'll see a fair amount of it from Mr. Trump whenever it is that he leaves. And Roosevelt had it. He just couldn't take it that somebody else could possibly be the president of the United States. And particularly during World War One, he thought he didn't get a war. He lived under 7 years and 171 days of peace. And he thought, hey, if there's going to be a world war, I get to be president.
I'm the guy. If ever there was a guy built for that job, it's him.
And he's right, except the only problem was, how do you keep him in the Oval Office? You know, he wants to ride his horse over into the Flanders field.
He did. He wanted to serve in World War One. Then. I mean, you thought he was too old to fight
Wilson.
In Cuba. He was way too old to fight in World War One. He wanted to go over there.
And his health has been broken, and, I mean, he's fat. He's unfit. His health was broken. So he goes into Wilson. You know, like, he's treated Wilson worse than President Trump has treated Obama or Mrs. Clinton.
Wow.
He goes into Wilson and says, no offense, let's just regard that as all like water under the dam. Now I want you to send me over to France with a Rough Rider group. And Wilson is like, well, you know, there is justice in this world. We're not going to, you're too old. And by the way, you're fat.
Yeah. Well, and he would have, if he had been in the field, he probably would have got killed. His son did.
He wanted to be killed. His view was, what would be better than to be killed on the fields of France? Like, what?
This is where I turn on him on stage, maybe, then, because if he's going to say that, I don't understand that either. If you have an obligation to your country, and by the way, they don't need you to die in Europe now. They didn't need you to die in Cuba. But if that's your thing, fine. But then what is your obligation to your sons? What's your obligation to your wife? What's your obligation to your family and friends? What's your obligation to the other things you could do? I do. That's appalling to me.
John, if you're going to use that tone on stage, you might get punched in the snout. You know, that tone, that kind of snotty,
elitist,
that kind of righteous tone,
yes,
that might work with Jefferson. That's not going to work. You know, I think you should be a little careful.
So if you're going to slug them, are there still tickets available?
Yeah, now we're going to sell some tickets.
Yeah, I'll deck you in 30 seconds, and then I have to go on without you.
All right, we're out of time. You're listening to...
I can't wait. This is going to be so much fun next week. I hope everyone comes, and I promise that if I hit you, it'll be a stage hit.
Okay. Right. Don't rush the stage. And, you know, we didn't even get to, even as now, we sort of wonder what we should do on stage. But I think Roosevelt is at his best when he explains the women in his life. The program has a note that says whatever his accomplishments, the women were the... in his life were his greatest vexation, his greatest conundrum. And I'd like to hear his reaction to that then.
Well, his daughter, Alice, you have sons, John. I have a daughter. So, and a daughter can really mess with a father's equanimity, let's put it. And Alice was born. She had Roosevelt's energy and drive.
Yeah.
And yet nowhere to put it. And so she addressed a lot of it right at Papa.
Yeah. All right, we're out of time. So tickets for the show, not this Saturday, not tomorrow, but next Saturday, Elgin Community College. Can you be there at the Blizzard Theater, 10:30 in the morning?
Come on, come all.
Roosevelt talks on stage with me for a little while. You get to ask questions and learn and laugh. Tickets are at WGNradio.com/Teddy, or just call the Blizzard box office at Elgin Community College. We'll see you in a week, my friend.
I can't wait to see you, John. Hello, everyone. Come to the program.
I don't think you can get a seat on the floor. The balcony seats are pretty good.